afternoon. Our third case for the day is 12 AP 1593 CR State v. Talberg. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Talberg is it Schmeiser or Schmeiser?
Schmeiser.
Schmeiser. Sarah M. Schmeiser. Attorney Schmeiser. You have 25 minutes, counsel. Assistant Attorney General Christine Remington has 30 minutes, and then Ms. Schmeiser, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Sarah Schmeiser, and my client is Michael Talberg. Good afternoon. The officer had many options. There was no emergency such that the only way to preserve the evidence was a warrantless bodily intrusion without any consent. This case started with an accident. A pickup truck flipped over, one person was trapped underneath and died. When the police arrived at the scene, there was no one else present. Within 5 to 10 minutes, the officer received information that two other people who had been in the vehicle were on their way to the hospital. Officer Hoffman then went to the hospital to interview them while other officers remained at the scene of the accident. Hoffman questioned my client, Michael Talberg, at the hospital at least two separate times, at one point becoming so heated that Talberg's mother intervened. But in all the questions he asked, he never did ask one simple question: will you agree to a blood test? Hoffman also did not read the informing the accused form and ask if Talberg would agree to a test under the implied consent statute. Hoffman was at the beginning stages of a serious investigation. Information was coming in from multiple witnesses and law enforcement officers. Ultimately, no less than 4 search warrants were obtained in the case. Under the facts and circumstances at the time, Hoffman did not have probable cause to arrest, and he did not, in fact, arrest Mr. Talberg. Hoffman never attempted or asked any other officer to attempt to get a search warrant on the facts known at that time. Hoffman spoke with Talberg, with another witness at the hospital, Ashley Miller, and then he spoke by telephone with an officer who was still at the scene of the accident. Hoffman testified at a later motion hearing that it was at that point, after his conversation with that officer, that he felt he had probable cause to believe that Talberg was the driver of the vehicle that was in the accident and that Talberg was impaired by alcohol when he was driving. But Hoffman did not follow normal procedure for an OWI investigation. He specified what normal procedure was and would have been at the earlier motion hearing. Even for an investigation which involved a death and serious injury, where normal field sobriety tests cannot be conducted, he talked about how it is possible to continue an investigation, have a preliminary breath test under many circumstances, and see what the facts and circumstances are at the time. Here, there were no exigent circumstances to justify the warrantless blood draw. Exigent circumstances is an emergency where there's no other way to preserve that evidence.
Well, weren't they getting close to the three-hour mark that he thought was significant for dissipation?
There was some contention about how close they were to the 3 hours. But the three-hour mark doesn't have anything to do with dissipation of alcohol in the blood. Alcohol dissipates at a regular known rate or range of rate over time. The 3 hours has to do with admissibility, automatic admissibility. However, in a blood draw, an analyst is required to testify in order to get the test result in normally in trial court, and this would be no different whether it was before the 3 hours or after the 3 hours.
To say there was no probable cause to arrest. He had red eyes, glassy eyes. He smelled of an intoxicant. He had slurred speech, and he admitted that he had been drinking, even though there was, I gather, no admission of how much and how long, right? So why isn't that probable? And he was, once he decides, the officer decides that there's enough evidence here that he was the driver, and there is the position of the body under the car, the fact that the driver showed signs of the airbag having imploded, and the only airbag was on the driver's side of the car. I mean defendant there. All that is probable cause. He was a driver. And looks to me as if there's enough there to show intoxication.
Well, I think there are two questions about probable cause. First was whether he was impaired, and second was whether he was the driver. And we would contend that the information that he was the driver of the vehicle was not sufficient. However, even if you consider it to be sufficient, he was not under arrest.
And why do I care whether he's under arrest or not? Bowling has one of the factors, arrest. But cases after bowling didn't stress arrest at all.
However, they may not have stressed arrest, but as far as I know, there's only one published decision that actually had a case where there was not an arrest. That was State v. Erickson. And in that case, the implied consent statute was read. So they were following the implied consent procedure in that case as opposed to this one. Further, I believe that Erickson, the language in Erickson differentiates or is different from the language in Schmerber, even the language in Bowling, certainly the language in McNeely now that talks about the importance of the level of probable cause that's needed in order to get a search that includes bodily intrusion. Schmerber specifically states that that is a higher level, says that search incident to arrest has little applicability with respect to searches involving intrusions beyond the body's surface, and draws a clear distinction. Erickson separates from that and talks about Bentley, which was actually an older case. There is some discussion of Swanson and Erickson, but overall it does not go along with that line of cases that is Schmerber and even in Bowling that require arrest and talk about how important that is. In Swanson...
Let me interrupt you for a minute. Let me take you back to where you started this afternoon. You told us that the rights form was never read to the defendant. Therefore, he was not asked whether or not he consented or objected to the blood test. Let's assume for a minute that the form had been read, and let's assume for a minute that he had not objected to the taking of the test. Would you be here this afternoon?
No, I would not. Not under this posture. The implied consent procedure has been challenged recently. The Court of Appeals decided in State versus Padley that if a person gives consent after being read the implied consent law, that is actual consent to a test and is a constitutional search.
So you find the lack of reading the form and the lack of being asked whether or not to consent to be significant given the most recent case?
I do. And not only the most recent case, even older cases such as State v. Zilke discuss other constitutional means tests, including straight consent. There's the implied consent law, which sets forth a procedure, and Zilke says it's best practice for officers to follow the implied consent law so that they do not run afoul of the Fourth Amendment. But it also says that you can just ask for consent. You don't have to read the form first. You don't have to go through this formality or this rigmarole. You can say, will you consent to a blood test? And if the person says yes, that is another constitutional means search, and we would not be here challenging that.
I thought the state this morning in response to questions said, if you read the consent forms under the law and the defendant neither says yes or no, that it's treated as not giving consent.
I believe that that is an open question under my reading of State v. Padley, that there is question. There has to be an actual consent, not a person who either does not answer or a person who is unconscious. Those things may be separate. We're not dealing with those facts today, but certainly that would raise a separate question under the implied consent law if the person does not explicitly say yes.
Counsel, so, how...
Your answer to Justice Crooks about suppose that he was given this consent information and he neither objected nor said yes, that's an open question as to whether he consents.
Correct. That is, if there's no clear answer given, that is an open question.
Okay.
Counsel, how should we treat the factors? When you went over the factual background of this case at the beginning of your presentation, a couple of things were not mentioned. And the first is that when the deputy arrived at the hospital to speak with your client told him that Matt, quote-unquote Matt, apparently referring to the decedent here, was actually the one who had been driving the vehicle at the time of the fatal crash. The deputy, as far as I recollect the record in this matter, took steps to confer with other investigating officers who either were on the scene or had been on the scene. And it was only at that point, after conferring with the sergeant, that Deputy Hoffman decided that a blood draw was appropriate. And then at that point, as far as I read the record and as far as the circuit court found, as a matter of fact, the medical professionals wanted to perform a CT scan. And the deputy did not want to get in the way of that. Now, my first question is, how should we factor in, or how should we treat, in this opinion, in our consideration of this matter, the fact that some of the delay was caused by apparently, your client telling the officer that somebody else drove the motor vehicle. And second, what would you have had the deputy do under the circumstances when the medical staff is telling the deputy that they need the patient to take a CT scan?
First, I would say that, going to your last question, that there's a couple of things I think the deputy could have done. First, there was a delay between him entering the room and the medical staff wanting the CT scan.
Well, that's when the questioning took place.
There was questioning at that time, yes. And we do not know why he did not at that time either arrest Mr. Tolber, read him the informing the accused form, ask for a blood draw.
Could it be because you're talking about re-entering after conferring?
Correct.
Okay. Please proceed.
Re-entered after conferring and went back to Mr. Tolberg and questioned him further. Mr. Tolberg had been moved to another location, and the staff later told him that they were going to perform a CT scan. We do not know how much time passed in between those two times, but there was questioning. And I believe the officer admitted that it was sharp questioning of Tolberg during that time. When the medical staff said, we want a CT scan, he says, draw his blood, and his blood is drawn. There's enough time there, right there, to say, will you allow us to draw your blood? He could have just asked the question. He also could have, at the point he realizes he has probable cause to arrest and is going to want a blood draw, he could have sought out a warrant. He could have made a telephone call. Any of the officers on the scene, because we know there were multiple officers investigating, could have called. There was no attempt to obtain a warrant. The judge in the circuit court decision references the fact that that the officer could have called dispatch. Dispatch would have contacted then the on-call prosecutor and magistrate.
Would this be before the CT scan or after?
Well, if he had asked, how long is the CT scan going to last? Is it going to take 20 minutes? When is the CT scan actually going to occur? We do not know when it happened. We do not know how long it took. We know there was enough time for him to feel that he wasn't impinging on Mr. Tolberg's medical treatment by obtaining the blood itself. So I think at the very least, there's time to make a phone call, there's time to ask two questions. One question, he had asked, can I have 5 minutes to read this form and get the blood draw? Can I ask him a three-second question, can I take your blood? All of these options are available, and exigent circumstances means there's no other way to get that evidence.
Counselor, what if he read the informing the accused form and your client refused to have a blood draw? Then where are we?
Well, that is addressed in State v. Erickson. That is a Court of Appeals decision that I think some of the language is a little inartful, but that is the situation that occurs basically in State v. Erickson, and it was held to be a constitutional blood draw under the law of that time. This situation is outside of that. Had, however, he refused, there's penalties for that, and that's another factor that goes into the exigent circumstances analysis.
Why didn't you answer that what the deputy could do under these circumstances is just trying, why don't you just get a warrant? Gets a warrant.
He could have tried to get a warrant. And there's...
This was what county, Shawano?
This is Shawano County. There was mention in the underlying record that there was telephonic warrants available. There was on-call prosecutor and magistrate. There was also multiple law enforcement officers investigating both at the scene where there was not injured people or emergency circumstances. They were measuring. They were taking photographs. That all could have gone towards time to get a warrant. And I think this is, again, something that is stated in McNeely that goes into the exigent circumstances analysis. If they had tried, someone had tried to get a warrant, and then there had been a delay in getting it, that may be an exigent circumstance. But that's not the facts here. And the state has the burden to show that there was not time to get a search warrant.
Did they show that?
No.
Was there any discussion that they attempted a warrant?
They did not attempt a warrant. The officer said I don't know his exact words, but basically said it never occurred to him to try to get a warrant.
Because the 3 hours were coming up.
He said that time was passing. Just because of the time passing and the medical treatment, he felt that he had to immediately take the blood.
I don't know if you heard the discussion this morning, but at least some of the lawyers thought that the essence of McNeely was one, no per se dissipation justifies exigent circumstances, and number two, exigent circumstances hard to prove if you don't show you attempted a warrant or you couldn't get a warrant within the time frame, although there was some discussion about what McNeely really means.
Yes, I was...
Is that your application in this case? Of McNeely?
Yes. I think one of the lessons from McNeely is that the Fourth Amendment will not tolerate per se rules. The difficulty then for this court is trying to determine how to convey to police officers what their duties and obligations are in a way that doesn't run afoul of the Fourth Amendment. I think if you're going to try and set out a rule, the best one is try to get a warrant. That, at least, is a constitutional standard that is an attempt. It doesn't say that in all circumstances you're not going to get one or you are going to get one. But to me, the Fourth Amendment, this pronouncement, Dearborn, many other cases, basically say you cannot have per se rules. You have to look at the facts and circumstances of the case and determine whether that officer at that point had exigent circumstances, whether there was any other way to preserve that evidence, or if it was such an emergency, it would have to be right then. I mean, I think there are clear-cut cases. If you see someone holding a baggie of powder over a toilet, that's an exigent circumstance, right? How far away from that can you go without attempting at least to get a warrant? And how can you tell that the evidence is going to be destroyed if you don't act immediately and urgently? Now, McNeely talks about the fact that time passage, alcohol dissipation in blood in and of itself is not sufficient because we know the approximate rate that the alcohol is going to dissipate over time, and that can be dealt with.
What
What time was the accident?
Nobody knows is the basic record. The officer testified that the first 911 call came in at about 12:55. They know that the accident occurred sometime before that. The officer doesn't know how long. He said anywhere from 10 minutes or so before, basically. But nobody knows exactly when the accident occurred. The first 911 call came in at 12:55. The blood was drawn at 3:05, just over 2 hours after that 911 call.
Could the accident have occurred at 12:30?
It could have.
Would it have occurred before 12:30?
It could have. On the record, the way that I have read it, there is no way of knowing the exact time of the accident.
Okay. Who called 911?
There were two calls that came into 911. It was the father and brother of Michael Tolberg. Both called in saying there had been an accident and emergency personnel were needed.
Were they at the scene of the accident at the time of the accident?
They were not at the scene of the accident at the time of the accident. They arrived at the scene of the accident 5 to 10 minutes after the officer did.
Okay, so someone had to alert them.
Correct.
What time were they alerted?
That is not in the record.
So the officer could have thought this accident occurred quite a bit before 12:55.
He did address that at the motion hearing, actually. The officer testified directly. It was his belief that the accident had occurred, he didn't give an exact time period, 10 to 20 minutes prior to the initial 911 call, I believe is approximately what his testimony boiled down to.
Okay. Now, we had a case last term that involved a search warrant or the possibility of a search warrant, and the testimony was it generally takes 2 to 3 hours to get a search warrant. Now, those were different times. What's the process for getting a search warrant in a case like this?
Well, I have quite a bit of experience in handling drunk driving defense, and I see many search warrants that are filled out by the officer. They have a pre-printed form. They fill it out. They contact a magistrate by telephone. They read it to them, and they get their search warrant approved very quickly. Some counties, they will actually go to where the magistrate is and have a conversation and a signature. Again, generally speaking, I have seen that all occur in a fairly short time period.
What's fairly short?
Anywhere from, I've seen warrants they were able to obtain warrants in less than 20 minutes.
Okay, but now, when did this accident occur?
This accident occurred in 2009, I believe.
2009. That was before McNeely.
It was.
Did they have pre-printed forms then?
I do not believe they had pre-printed forms.
Okay. Didn't you say that there was a prosecutor on duty that night?
Indeed. The trial court references and there wasn't testimony by the officer, but there was the trial court, in making its decision, said that the officer could call dispatch and get through to the on-duty prosecutor and magistrate. That was not attempted, but it is specifically referenced by the judge as a possibility.
But do you really think this would have taken 15 to 20 minutes back in 2009?
I do not know. Telephonic warrants were available. There's a statute in Wisconsin that allows for that. That was in place in 2009. We have no way of knowing, and that's part of why I say the state has not met their burden. That it's a heavy and difficult burden to rebut, and they have to show that that warrant was not available or that there was no other way to obtain the evidence.
Was it normal to try to obtain a warrant for securing blood in July 2009?
Not for drunk driving cases, to my knowledge, no. However, there were other cases in which they needed to obtain evidence that they were able to secure warrants for by telephone. And It was normal in 2009 to follow the implied consent procedure. It was normal to ask for consent to draw the blood, and none of that was done either.
Well, what do you mean by normal? Don't you mean what the law is? I mean, the law would require consent. The law would require that information be given about the implied consent law. Don't you mean by normal here? And isn't the question as to normal mean whether the bowling standard was should have been applied? Isn't that what the normal is? Bowling meaning dissipation of alcohol is enough for exigent circumstance? I mean, I don't know what normal means.
I think that bowling, yes, it means that the law should have been applied in several different ways. There were several different options open to the officer, and he took none of them. The bowling procedure was one option, which he did not follow.
He followed it, except he didn't make an arrest.
Correct.
Okay. On Erickson, they didn't need an arrest.
In Erickson, they discussed not needing an arrest. However, that is an implied consent case. The implied consent warnings were read. So it is a different posture. In addition, Erickson ignores the language in Schmerber, the language that was in Bowling, the language that's now in McNeely.
Well, I don't think they ignored it. I think what they said, that in an OMVWI case, the probable cause to search for evidence of alcohol intoxication in someone goes hand in hand, I think that was the term they used, with probable cause to arrest for having a prohibited alcohol concentration.
And I think there's language in Schmerber that directly contradicts that, that says,
I have Schmerber, so when you get there, let me know what page you're on.
Page 769.
769?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
First full paragraph at the bottom talks about the applicability of search incident to arrest to bodily intrusion. And going on to page 770, talks about how the Fourth Amendment forbid any such intrusions on the mere chance that desired evidence might be obtained in absence of clear indication, continues to talk about the need to not only have probable cause to arrest, but also to have further probable cause that the evidence sought is likely to be found in the blood in order to justify the warrantless bodily intrusion.
Well, you can't really search someone for evidence of alcohol intoxication unless you think, you have reason to believe, that they've got alcohol in their blood. And you can't arrest someone for alcohol intoxication unless you believe they've got alcohol in their blood. I don't see the distinction. I'm looking at Schermer. I just don't see the distinction. I'm looking where you're talking, page 669 to 670.
Well, I would argue that Schmerber just talks about bodily intrusion as having heightened beyond the normal needs, and that is also carried through.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. That part, I don't disagree with you about that. It just seems to me that if you're arresting somebody for having a prohibited alcohol concentration, and you're searching somebody to see if they have a prohibited alcohol concentration, probable cause to support one has got to be the same as probable cause to support the other. Either you've got it for both or you don't have it for either.
I would agree with you in many situations. However, I'm not sure that every situation will fit those facts. And we have a case here where there's some question whether he was driving or not, which is a separate issue with probable cause as to whether he showed any signs of impairment.
Well, I think that whether he's driving or not is a fact question. Obviously, he went to the jury, and the jury had to find he was driving or he wouldn't have gotten convicted. I agree with you. He's continued to deny that he was the driver. But I think given what the officer had with the car that's lying on top of, with the driver's side door down, on top of the dead man who he claims was driving, now, that is reasonable, I think, for the officer to believe that if you were driving, you wouldn't end up underneath the car on the door on the side you were supposed to be sitting on. I mean, I can understand his thought process. Whether it was proved or not, well, it was apparently proved at trial that he was the driver. He wouldn't have been convicted. But I do see what you're saying, so thank you.
And if I could just, on that point, I think that Swanson has the clearest statement saying that there's no exception to warrantless searches based solely on probable cause. And there was no arrest here. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Remington, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Christine Remington, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this matter. The state of Wisconsin's position that there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Talberg for driving while under the influence of an intoxicant, and that the warrantless search of his blood was justified by exigent circumstances. In the alternative, the state believes that good faith should apply to this case because at the time, in 2009 of the accident, bowling was the law in the state of Wisconsin, and that said that exigent circumstances were automatic in cases there was a per se rule that the blood draw could be happened. A warrantless blood draw could happen if you believe someone is driving under the influence. To correct a few things.
Relying on bowling for good faith?
I'm relying on bowling and cases interpreting bowling, including Erickson, which was discussed earlier, which interpreted bowling to say that an actual arrest isn't required, that probable cause to arrest is sufficient to satisfy the bowling requirement.
Bentley?
Erickson interpreted both bowling and Bentley and used that, I believe used that footnote in Bentley that said probable cause to arrest is sufficient to come to its conclusion.
Doesn't bowling itself say that probable cause is enough? I mean, I'm looking at footnote one in bowling. Probable cause to arrest substitutes for the predicate act of lawful arrest, citing State versus Bentley.
I don't have that in front of me right now, but that's the footnote that, yes, that Bentley footnote is the one that Erickson relied on, and maybe Bowling relied on it directly as well. The Bowling standards that are often cited, the criteria to satisfy Bowling, laid out that arrest was required.
The standards, the blood draw is taken to obtain evidence of intoxication from a person lawfully arrested for a drunk driving-related violation or crime. Footnote 1, probable cause to arrest substitutes for the predicate act of lawful arrest.
I think that's why Erickson came to that conclusion directly as well, because of the language in bowling. Maybe with that footnote says that, but Erickson made it plainly clear that an arrest is not required, that probable cause to arrest.
Could I ask you this question? If we never had a bowling decision, are there exigent circumstances to search without a warrant in this case?
Under these facts, it's the state's position that there are facts to support exigent circumstances.
Why don't you make the case for that?
All right. Well, the 911 call came in at 2:55.
12:55
a.m. And at that time, it was the defendant's father saying, "My son had been in an accident, and you need to go to the scene." They knew based on that call that the accident happened before 12:55. At the time the blood draw happened, the officer didn't have all these facts, but as the case progressed to trial, we learned, piecing together cell phone calls and listening to testimony of the people in the car, that the accident happened before 12:30. The vehicle left the bar just after midnight that night, and the first cell phone call, I believe, I'm not exactly clear on which the first cell phone call was, since I don't have the facts right in front of me, but there was There was a call saying, we've been in an accident, come help. The people in the accident searched around the vehicle for, I believe they said, 5 to 10 minutes, and trying to find Mr. Elf, the deceased. As they searched around, someone came to pick them up, took them to Mr. Talberg's mother's house. Then they went from the mother's house to the hospital. So we know that an amount of time happened, passed before the 911 call came in. But even regardless, we know the accident happened before 12:55, and the blood draw was at 3:05. Exigent circumstances are also supported by the fact that they didn't know who the driver of the vehicle was at the time they were dispatched to the accident. The officer went to talk to Mr. Talberg and Ashley Miller at the hospital to try and determine who was driving the vehicle. Both people told him that Mr. Elf was driving the vehicle. He then talked to the people on the scene and found out that Elf was not driving, that the driver's side airbag was the only one that deployed. And that's when he looked at Mr. Talberg, saw the redness on his arms, including the singed hair on his right arm, and determined that it was much more likely that Talberg had been the driver and not that Mr. Elf had been the driver.
Didn't they also observe residue from the...
Yes, the officer also smelled the odor of airbag residue, which he testified was a very distinct odor, which he did not smell on Ms. Miller at the time. And the other thing that I didn't mention is that Ms. Miller did not have the airbag odor, but she also had injuries consistent with being ejected from the vehicle at the time of the crash, and therefore the officer concluded that she was likely in the bed of the truck and had been ejected. And so at that time, the officer thought there were three people in the car, Mr. Talberg, Mr. Elf, and Ms. Miller. He had ruled out Mr. Elf because he was trapped under the vehicle. He had ruled out Ms. Miller because she did not have this odor. He had all these things that made him think that it was Mr. Talberg driving, including the smell of the airbag, the singed arms, the fact that it was Mr. Talberg's truck, which it would not alone be enough, but it was definitely part of the probable cause to believe that Mr. Talberg was the driver. He smelled of intoxicants. He admitted to drinking. I believe he admitted to drinking a mixed drink and a Jaeger bomb, but I don't know if he admitted to drinking any more than that. At that point, the officer did not go back in to interrogate Mr. Talberg. There was, I believe, the testimony of the suppression motion. The officer testified on page 43 of the suppression motion that there was no second interview. That he interviewed Mr. Talberg, he interviewed Ms. Miller, he talked to the deputies on the scene, and that's at the point where he said, I have probable cause to believe Mr. Talberg was driving this vehicle and that he was driving it while intoxicated. And that at that point, he went in to draw the blood. And he testified that he did not have 5 minutes to read the informing the accused form because the hospital staff were persistent in performing a CT scan. So when he went back to he decided he had probable cause to believe that he had the driver, and then when the hospital staff said, I need to take him right now, that's when he felt he had exigent circumstances. There is not testimony about how long it would take to get a warrant. He testified that he did not have time to get a warrant, but offered no details into support of that. But he did testify that he didn't have the 5 minutes he would need to read the informing the accused form, and the circuit court determined that a search warrant would take longer than that 5 minutes, and therefore found that there was not time to get a warrant in this.
Did Mr. Talberg denied being the driver, is that right?
He denied being the driver.
He asserted somebody else was the driver.
He asserted that Mr. Elf was the driver, and Ms. Miller told the officer the same story.
Did that cause any delay?
Huh?
Did that cause a delay?
It did cause a delay because he interviewed Mr. Talberg and he interviewed Ms. Miller, and then he talked to the officers on the scene to compare what he had heard. Because one of the other things that Mr. Talberg had told him was that the passenger side airbag deployed, and that's why he smelled of this odor, and that's why he had the singed arm hair. And then after time, and then when he talked to the officers on the scene and found out that that was not the case, yeah, all of this time was passing throughout all of this. And a lot of the passage of time was due to Mr. Tolberg leaving the scene of the accident and telling the officer that he was not the driver and trying to deflect blame for the...
Does the record indicate approximately how far geographically the scene of the accident was from the hospital?
There was no testimony at the suppression hearing about that, and I don't know if it was elsewhere in the record at trial, but I don't believe so.
Okay.
So exactly what are the exigent circumstances? We're now running at close to 3 hours because the accident could have been 12:30, and the draw is 3, right?
Yes.
So time is running. That's the dissipation argument, right?
The dissipation of alcohol and the amount of time that has passed.
All right. But that alone is not going to do it.
That alone is not going to do it.
So what do you have?
We also have the medical treatment needs of Mr. Tolberg.
Okay, that's going to cause more delay.
The fact that if they waited till after his CT scan, that would have caused even a longer delay.
That goes to dissipation. The longer the delay there, is maybe dissipation, although it's not clear about, you know, dissipation has a curve in it.
Sure.
Right. Okay. The CT scan is dissipation.
But it's also the fact that Mr. Tolberg had lied to the deputy to say that he was not the driver, which caused more of
He caused some of the delay, but again, the delay goes to dissipation. I mean, the fact that he caused that delay. Was that, how does that make it an exigent circumstance other than there is, again, dissipation?
There's also the fact that there was not time to get the warrant. There was...
Now, who testified to that?
The officer testified that he did not have time to get a warrant. He also testified that he did not have 5 minutes to read the informing the accused form to the defendant.
Did he give any indication of why he didn't have time for a warrant, what the timing would have been in Shawano County?
He did not.
An officer couldn't take 5 minutes for the implied, right?
He testified that he didn't have 5 minutes to read the informing the accused form. And there was no testimony about how long it would have taken to get the warrant, but it's implied throughout the suppression hearing that it would have been longer than that 5 minutes, that if we didn't have these 5 minutes, it would have taken longer. But there's no testimony about how long it would have taken to get a warrant or whether there was what the procedure was.
How did the circuit court make that finding on judicial notice?
How did the circuit court?
I thought the circuit court made a finding that it would have taken longer than the 5 minutes regarding getting a warrant.
It must have been judicial notice. There was no testimony from the deputy about how long it would take.
Am I correct that that's what the circuit court found?
I believe you are correct that that was a finding that the court made. But it must have been based on the court's knowledge of the procedure for getting the warrant.
The trial court decision, which is in the blue brief, has... deals with several different issues, as I read it, right?
Yes, there were some issues that Mr. Tolberg raised that he is.
Right. And so I went to number 3 at page A14 about blood draw. Defendant was in the same position
is the defendant in the Scales case. Both men had not been told that they were under arrest. Both men had blood seized due to exigent circumstances, namely elimination of alcohol from the body, which made obtaining a warrant impractical. That's dissipation. Court went through a more thorough analysis at the motion hearing held on suppression and continues to believe that exigent circumstances justified the search. By the time the blood was seized, Hoffman had good reason to believe the defendant's story was not accurate as to the driver. Okay, that would go to probable cause to search or probable cause to arrest. And the position of Alf goes to that. Only the driver's airbag goes to the issue of who was driving, right? So it seems to me, at least from that decision, that the main thing that the trial court was relying on was dissipation. Now, can you point to something in the original transcript from the suppression hearing which does more than dissipation?
Well, I think there's two things as far as dissipation. There's the bowling rule, which said we can draw blood at any point because alcohol is constantly being dissipated from people.
Per se rule.
But in Schmerber, they discussed dissipation in the context of the facts of that case. And in that case, part of why they found exigent circumstances was based on the fact that over 2 hours had passed since the time of the accident. So I don't believe that the passage of time only goes to dissipation. I believe it also goes to findings of exigent circumstances in support of the loss of evidence. That under McNeely and Schmerber, the alcohol is being dissipated from the blood, but that alone was not sufficient. There had needed to be more, including this passage of time and the fact that it would have taken a long time to get a warrant, or longer than is available to get the warrant.
Well, if you look at page 23 of the transcript, it's a dissipation. That's the argument. The 5 minutes is on page 52 of the transcript about couldn't have 5 minutes for CT. Where, maybe you don't have this, where in the transcript do they talk about how long it would take to get a warrant?
I don't believe they talk about how long it would take to get the warrant. I think, and I don't have the page off the top of my head. I believe it's in my brief. What page the deputy testified that he did not have time to get a warrant. He did testify there was no time to get a warrant. He did not testify as to how long it would take to get the warrant.
It was a conclusion. He gave no factual basis.
It was a conclusion, yes. And that's all because at the time of in 2009, when this accident had happened, they still were operating under the bowling. There's exigent circumstances because we believe that.
So they were relying on the per se rule.
They were relying on the per se rule, which is why there wasn't more testimony about the timing and wasn't.
You know that footnote in the case on whether a probable cause to arrest is the equivalent of probable cause to arrest substitutes for the predicate act of lawful arrest, citing Bentley. Bentley's a very short opinion, and it says the taking of the blood sample is a search and seizure within both constitutions. It can be conducted if it's incident to arrest. Logic dictates that where there's probable cause to arrest, one need not perform the formalistic rituals of arrest. That's a little strange because we view whether there is an arrest is significant in a number of instances. Then it says probable cause to arrest standing alone does not justify taking a blood sample for a blood test without first obtaining a search warrant. and the site there is to Schmerber. Such a search and seizure is further subject to scrutiny under the Fourth Amendment. So just probable cause is not good enough. To be admissible in addition to probable cause, it must have been required by exigencies, which is what we're discussing now. And the sample must have been drawn in a reasonable manner. Now, you rely on exigency. And if that, your alternative, as I understand your brief, is good faith.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Even though at the time of this accident, bowling was still the law, under the facts of this case, it's the state's position that there were exigent circumstances under McNeely as it was decided. However, we make the alternative argument that even if you do not find there exigent circumstances under McNeely as the law is right now, good faith should apply to the officer's actions at this point because the officer was acting under good faith. He was acting in reasonable reliance on binding precedent, and therefore, even if this court were to conclude that that exigent circumstances do not justify the warrantless blood draw, this court should apply good faith and not the exclusionary rule.
I was a little surprised in the arguments this morning and yours that you don't place heavy reliance on Reese, where a recent court of appeals, which I think is published, Reese is published.
Yes, Reese is published.
And constitutes the law, unless we change it, there weren't exigent circumstances in that case, and maybe they were similar to here, but that under the good faith, it was admissible. The evidence was admissible because McNeely wasn't in effect here because Bowling said it's per se. So, and then there is a cite, I think it's in your brief, to some unpublished opinions which
rely on it.
And so what you have is various people now who have been convicted because the evidence wasn't suppressed, because they accept Bowling and say McNeely may be retroactive, but it is overturned. McNeely yields to good faith. That's the state's position.
Yes, it's the state's position, and I do rely on Reese's.
In your briefs, you do.
Yes, and that in Reese, the Court of Appeals found that good faith applies to warrantless blood draws that were based on exigent circumstances conducted prior to McNeely. And Reese has been relied on. At the time I wrote my brief, I believe I said it to two unpublished one-judge cases that relied on it, and I believe there are more at this point.
Could I ask, the McNeely case caused some consternation among judges? And I suspect among law enforcement personnel. Did the Department of Justice take any action to make life easier for either or participate?
Well, the Department of Justice trains police officers as to what the state of the law is. And I know after McNeely was decided that the training included a message to get a warrant whenever you can and to make every effort to do that, and that we no longer could just rely on Bowling and automatic exigent circumstances.
We've had references in the arguments today about sort of simplified forms that the officers have that they fill out to help them obtain a warrant. Do you know the origin of are those forms uniform, or does each county develop one, or does the department, or what's the story here?
I don't know the origin of those. I believe that each county is implementing a slightly different system. I mean, I think that there was some talk this morning about Dane County and an automated handwritten form. And I think in some counties where there's a one judge, yeah, you might be relying on, you know, whether the judge answers his phone at 2 a.m. when you're calling. And I think that it varies greatly county to county across the state of Wisconsin as to how long it takes to get these warrants. It also, and I think that the how long it takes to get the warrants is definitely part of the totality of the circumstances analysis that courts need to go through. The other thing that is part of this discussion is it varies greatly across the state as to how long it takes to get someone to a hospital, to someone who can perform the blood draw. I mean, in downtown Madison, you'd be able to get to a hospital within a few minutes, but in some rural counties, it might take an hour or more to get the person to the hospital, and that would also be another factor that would have to be analyzed within.
Is Langlade Hospital in Langlade County? I mean, is that Antigo or?
In this, in, I, you know, I'm not even sure exactly.
May the record reflect.
All right.
It would seem to me that Shawano County, where this incident occurred,
mm-hmm.
is not Langlade County. So.
But I haven't looked at a map to see. I mean, I don't know if that was the closest hospital. I mean, in this case, it wasn't a case where the officer was transporting the defendant to the nearest hospital. This was the defendant going to his mother's house and then choosing which hospital to go to. So I don't know that we know whether this was the nearest hospital or even how long it took him to get there, because we know definitely what time the 911 call came in, and we don't know what time the blood was drawn. I don't believe the record is completely clear as to what time the officer got to the hospital and started interviewing Mr. Tullberg and then interviewed Ms. Miller. Like, those things are not all there, and we don't know what time Mr. Tullberg got to the hospital or any of those things. But to your broader point, I think we don't. I think the discussion of the totality of the circumstances, the factors that should be considered, should include things such as how long it takes to get to the hospital and how long it's been since the crime had occurred and how long it would take to get a warrant county by county. I believe that with McNeely, there's testimony in cases that have happened post-McNeely about all of those things at suppression motion hearings. And we don't have that on the record here because this happened prior. Although under these circumstances, it is the state's position that these are the sorts of circumstances that would, under the totality of the circumstances, constitute exigent.
Did you get an opportunity to check the trial court local rules and whether after McNeely they adopted any local rules about duty judges to to sign the warrant and regional approaches, et cetera? Because my recollection was the Department of Justice educates the police officers, but it's the court system that educates judges and adopts procedures, either statewide or advises judges about adopting local procedures or regional procedures for purposes of making U.S. Supreme Court decisions applicable and workable.
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly how that's operating in practice, but that would be my understanding. Well, the state asks that you affirm the Court of Appeals and the judgment of conviction in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Schweizer?
The exigent circumstances argument here from the state is based on time and the circumstances. Whose fault was it that time was used up? That time goes to dissipation. And at the time that the officer was at the hospital with Mr. Tullberg, the question is, what were his options? Did he have any other way to obtain the evidence? There are not exigent circumstances here because he did have other options. There were other ways to obtain the evidence. He said he didn't have 5 minutes to read the informing the accused form. However, he testified, and this is on page 43 of the transcript, I know he moved to a different room. That's where the blood draw was taken, and that's where I took the pictures. So he did interview Mr. Tolberg again, and he did take pictures, apparently without interrupting his medical treatment and having any other difficulties. He says, you were accusatory towards my client, were you not? I wouldn't say accusatory, but I wanted the truth is what I wanted. And that's when Mr. Tolberg's mother intervened because of the sharpness of the questioning. That all happened when he didn't have 5 minutes to read the informing the accused form. He then later testifies on page 51. The attorney asked him, you could have asked him to consent to a blood draw. Yes, but you didn't. No. There were other options here, and that goes to the exigency. In Schmerber, it was agreed that no warrant could be obtained within the time limit. It is not agreed here that no warrant could be obtained, but the main issue isn't necessarily the warrant. If you're relying on time as the only factor, you have the person here, you have him in the hospital, and you're saying you don't have time, you have to show that you don't have that time. And they couldn't show that because they didn't try. They didn't try to make a phone call. They didn't ask him.
They didn't try to make a phone call to do what?
To get a warrant.
And that phone call would have had to have taken place in between the time of the officer's questioning of Mr. Tolbert and the determination by medical staff that they needed to get the patient into a CT scan. True?
It would have had to take place while he was at the hospital after the officer made the determination.
So, yes.
Yes. I mean, there was a lot going on. He was able to take pictures.
So shouldn't we consider, as part of the totality of the circumstances, well, first of all, as far as the circuit court's finding goes, fair to say that Judge Habeck, as circuit court judge for Shawano County, would have a pretty decent idea of how long it takes to get a search warrant in that county?
I would assume so, and he references some of that on his understanding of how the procedure works.
Sure. And as part of our consideration of the totality of the circumstances, this is kind of coming back to the question I posed originally. I'm not sure I got a complete answer because we went right to the five-minute delay. Should we not consider, and you opened with this during your rebuttal, should we not consider who caused the delay?
No, you should not consider whether it was the officer or somebody else. The question is not the delay or who caused it. The question is what are the options at that point in time to obtain the evidence? Because the emergency need to get the evidence is the exigency.
Okay. I can see why you would want to take that position, but let's think this out logically. If the person who causes the delay is the person who benefits from the delay, does that person receive sort of a court prize for participating in the delay?
No, I would. When I did my research, there's a line of cases, not here in Wisconsin, but a line of cases that includes a U.S. Supreme Court decision that talk about if the officer creates an exigency, they don't get the benefit of the exigency.
What is your fault? You are finding fault with the deputy, and I'm trying to pin down. All I've heard so far is that he failed to make the phone call, which the circuit court judge found would have not yielded the search warrant within the time limit. And he failed to ask consent. Anything else that the deputy did wrong here?
I guess I would characterize this as the reason that it's an unconstitutional blood draw is that the deputy didn't follow any of the potential paths to a constitutional blood draw. So I'm not saying that he did something wrong in the sense that he purposely attacked somebody, but he had many options available to follow to get a constitutional blood draw.
He had many.
I have to ask one question.
thinking back on the times that I have done middle-of-the-night search warrants, if someone woke me up at 2 a.m. to do a warrant for a blood draw in an OWI back when bowling was the law, I would wonder what they were doing waking me up at 2 in the morning for something they can do on their own. What makes you think this would have been someone who would have been receptive to receiving this kind of inquiry at 2 a.m. when people weren't doing it? Do you know anyone in the state who issued these kinds of warrants at that time?
Well, I think that all counties had procedures to issue telephonic search warrants.
That's a different inquiry. But in light of the law that everyone was using, bowling, do you know any judge in the state of Wisconsin at this time that issued telephonic warrants for blood in an OWI-related incident?
No, I have no idea. And my argument isn't that that was the only option. It was one of the options that was available, but there were other options as well.
Fair enough.
Your argument is that McNeely changed that. Your argument is that McNeely requires, whether it was 2009 or 2005, McNeely requires that, look, it's a dispute as to what exactly McNeely requires, but a totality of circumstances, or I put it differently, McNeely says dissipation is not alone per se enough, and that dates back. The issue is the officer would not have gone for a warrant because he or she would have relied on bowling that you can, that dissipation is enough. And the officer relied on a Wisconsin case, which later turns out to be an incorrect view of the federal Constitution. So that's what the little problem is. So the judge wouldn't have been open, wouldn't have been called 2 a.m. or 2 p.m. because the officer wouldn't have thought it was necessary because it was per se dissipation.
Right.
And isn't that what the officer, what the state is relying on?
I believe that it is, yes. That is
that's
what they,
the good faith.
That is the good faith. However, I would argue that there's never been a finding of good faith in a bodily intrusion case until State v. Reese in the Court of Appeals.
Well, and you have, I think, a slight problem. The petition for review says the issue is whether or not there's exigent circumstances. In the discussion, the narrative on the petition for review, it says the court should deal with a warrantless draw prior to an arrest. And your brief spends a lot of time and a lot of effort saying arrest is essential and that you don't have any cases that say arrest isn't. And, of course, we have Bentley and there aren't cases. Most of the cases seem to just assume there is an arrest, although in many cases there was an arrest. So how do you get all that together?
Well, the only case that's been cited that where there wasn't a formal arrest was Erickson. Mm-hmm. Every other case there was an arrest. Most cases there was also the implied consent warnings that were given and requests for consent made under the implied consent statute. And Zilke also states that the officers should follow the implied consent law and that although you can ask for straight consent if you want another constitutional means, draw.
Right. Your red light's been on.
It has. Thank you.
Counsel, on behalf of the court, I want to thank both Ms. Schmeiser and Ms. Remington for the briefs and discussion of yet another McNulty case and Bentley and arrest and good faith of
drunk driving draws of blood. That concludes our discussion of 12-8-B-1593-CR, State v. Schulberg. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. We are in recess until we hear oral argument tomorrow at 9.